You're listening to From the Public Domain, stories and excerpts from the public domain. I'm your host, Susie Alphins. The Diamond Necklace by Guy de Maupassant. The girl was one of those pretty and charming young creatures who sometimes are born, as if by a slip of fate, into a family of clerks. She had no dowry, no expectations, no way of being known, understood, loved, married by any rich and distinguished man. So she let herself be married to a little clerk of the Ministry of Public Instruction. She dressed plainly, because she could not dress well. But she was unhappy, as if she had really fallen from a higher station, since with women there is neither caste nor rank, for beauty, grace, and charm take the place of family and birth. Natural ingenuity, instinct for what is elegant, a supple mind are their sole hierarchy, and often make of women of the people the equals of the very greatest ladies. Mathilde suffered ceaselessly, feeling herself born to enjoy all delicacies and all luxuries. She was distressed at the poverty of her dwelling, at the bareness of the walls, at the shabby chairs, the ugliness of the curtains, all those things, of which another woman of her rank would never even have been conscious, tortured her, and made her angry. The sight of the little Breton peasant who did her humble housework aroused in her despairing regrets and bewildering dreams. She thought of silent antechambers hung with oriental tapestry, illumined by tall bronze candelabra, and of two great footmen in knee breeches who sleep in the big armchairs, made drowsy by the oppressive heat of the stove. She thought of long reception halls hung with ancient silk, of the dainty cabinets containing priceless curiosities, and of the little coquettish perfumed reception rooms made for chatting at 5 o'clock with intimate friends, with men famous and sought after, whom all women envy and whose attention they all desire. When she sat down to dinner before the round table covered with a tablecloth in use 3 days, opposite her husband, who uncovered the soup tureen and declared with a delighted air, "Ah, the good soup! I don't know anything better than that." She thought of dainty dinners, of shining silverware, of tapestry that peopled the walls with ancient personages, and with strange birds flying in the midst of a fairy forest. And she thought of delicious dishes served on marvelous plates, and of the whispered gallantries to which you listen with a sphinx-like smile while you are eating the pink meat of a trout or the wings of a quail. She had no gowns, no jewels, nothing. And she loved nothing but that. She felt made for that. She would have liked so much to please, to be envied, to be charming, to be sought after. She had a friend, a former schoolmate at the convent, who was rich, and whom she did not like to go to see anymore, because she felt so sad when she came home. But one evening, her husband reached home with a triumphant air and holding a large envelope in his hand. "There," he said, "there is something for you." She tore the paper quickly and drew out a printed card which bore these words: "The Minister of Public Instruction and Madame Georges Ramponneau request the honor of Monsieur and Madame Louisel's company at the Palace of the Ministry on Monday evening, January 18th. Instead of being delighted, as her husband had hoped, she threw the invitation on the table crossly, muttering, "What do you wish me to do with that?" "Why, my dear, I thought you would be glad. You never go out, and this is such a fine opportunity. I had great trouble to get it. Everyone wants to go. It is very select, and they are not giving many invitations to clerks. The whole official world will be there." She looked at him with an irritated glance and said impatiently, "And what do you wish me to put on my back?" He had not thought of that. He stammered, "Why, the gown you go to the theater in. It looks very well to me." He stopped, distracted, seeing that his wife was weeping. Two great tears ran slowly from the corners of her eyes toward the corners of her mouth. "What's the matter? What's the matter?" he answered. By a violent effort, she conquered her grief and replied in a calm voice, while she wiped her wet cheeks, "Nothing. Only,
I have no gown, and therefore I can't go to this ball. Give your card to some colleague whose wife is better equipped than I am. He was in despair. He resumed. Come, let us see, Mathilde. How much would it cost? A suitable gown, which you could use on other occasions. Something very simple.
She reflected several seconds, making her calculations, and wondering also what sum she could ask without drawing on herself an immediate refusal and a frightened exclamation from the economical clerk. Finally, she replied, hesitating,
I don't know exactly, but I think I could manage it with 400 francs.
He grew a little pale, because he was laying aside just that amount to buy a gun and treat himself to a little shooting next summer on the plain of Nanterre with several friends who went to shoot larks there of a Sunday. But he said,
Very well, I will give you 400 francs and try to have a pretty gown.
The day of the ball drew near, and Madame Loisel seemed sad, uneasy, anxious. Her frock was ready, however. Her husband said to her one evening,
What is the matter? Come, you have seemed very queer these last 3 days.
And she answered,
It annoys me not to have a single piece of jewelry, not a single ornament, nothing to put on. I shall look poverty-stricken. I would almost rather not go at all.
You might wear natural flowers, said her husband. They're very stylish at this time of year. For 10 francs, you can get 2 or 3 magnificent roses.
She was not convinced.
No, there's nothing more humiliating than to look poor among other women who are rich.
How stupid you are,
her husband cried.
Go, look up your friend, Madame Forestier, and ask her to lend you some jewels. You're intimate enough with her to do that.
She uttered a cry of joy.
True, I never thought of it.
The next day, she went to her friend and told her of her distress. Madame Forestier went to a wardrobe with a mirror, took out a large jewel box, brought it back, opened it, and said to Madame Loisel,
Choose, my dear.
She saw first some bracelets, then a pearl necklace, then a Venetian gold cross set with precious stones of admirable workmanship. She tried on the ornaments before the mirror, hesitated, and could not make up her mind to part with them, to give them back. She kept asking,
Haven't you any more?
Why, yes, look further. I don't know what you like.
Suddenly she discovered, in a black satin box, a superb diamond necklace, and her heart throbbed with an immoderate desire. Her hands trembled as she took it. She fastened it round her throat, outside her high-necked waist, and was lost in ecstasy at her reflection in the mirror. Then she asked, hesitating, filled with anxious doubt,
Will you lend me this?
Only this?
Why, yes, certainly.
She threw her arms round her friend's neck, kissed her passionately, then fled with her treasure. The night of the ball arrived. Madame Loisel was a great success. She was prettier than any other woman present, elegant, graceful, smiling, and wild with joy. All the men looked at her, asked her name, sought to be introduced. All the attachés of the cabinet wished to waltz with her. She was remarked by the minister himself. She danced with rapture, with passion, intoxicated by pleasure, forgetting all in the triumph of her beauty, in the glory of her success, in a sort of cloud of happiness comprised of all this homage, admiration. These awakened desires and of that sense of triumph which is so sweet to woman's heart. She left the ball about 4 o'clock in the morning. Her husband had been sleeping since midnight in a little deserted anteroom with 3 other gentlemen whose wives were enjoying the ball. He threw over her shoulders the wraps he had brought, the modest wraps of common life, the poverty of which contrasted with the elegance of the ball dress. She felt this and wished to escape so as not to be remarked by the other women, who were enveloping themselves in costly furs. Loiselle held her back, saying, "Wait a bit. You will catch cold outside. I will call a cab." But she did not listen to him and rapidly descended the stairs. When they reached the street, they could not find a carriage and began to look for one, shouting after the cabman passing at a distance. They went toward the Seine in despair, shivering with cold. At last they found on the quay one of those ancient nightcabs, which, as though they were ashamed to show their shabbiness during the day, are never seen round Paris until after dark. It took them to their dwelling in the Rue des Martyrs, and sadly, they mounted the stairs to their flat. All was ended for her. As to him, he reflected that he must be at the ministry at 10 o'clock that morning. She removed her wraps before the glass so as to see herself once more in all her glory. But suddenly she uttered a cry. She no longer had the necklace around her neck. "What is the matter with you?" demanded her husband, already half undressed. She turned distractedly toward him.
I've lost Madame Forestier's necklace," she cried.
He stood up, bewildered.
"What? How? Impossible."
They looked among the folds of her skirt, of her cloak, in her pockets, everywhere, but did not find it.
"You're sure you had it on when you left the ball?" he asked.
"Yes, I felt it in the vestibule of the minister's house."
"But if you had lost it in the street, we should have heard it fall. It must be in the cab."
"Yes, probably. Did you take his number?"
"No. And you, didn't you notice it?"
"No."
They looked, thunderstruck at each other. At last, Loiselle put on his clothes.
"I shall go back on foot," said he, "over the whole route, to see whether I can find it."
He went out. She sat waiting on a chair in her ball dress, without strength to go to bed, overwhelmed, without any fire, without a thought. Her husband returned about 7 o'clock. He had found nothing. He went to police headquarters, to the newspaper offices to offer a reward. He went to the cab companies, everywhere, in fact, whither he was urged by the least spark of hope. She waited all day, in the same condition of mad fear before this terrible calamity. Loiselle returned at night with a hollow, pale face. He had discovered nothing.
"You must write to your friend," said he, "that you have broken the clasp of her necklace and that you are having it mended. That will give us time to turn round."
She wrote at his dictation. At the end of a week, they had lost all hope. Loiselle, who had aged 5 years, declared,
"We must consider how to replace that ornament."
The next day, they took the box that had contained it and went to the jeweler, whose name was found within. He consulted his books.
"It was not I, madame, who sold that necklace. I must simply have furnished the case."
Then they went from jeweler to jeweler, searching for a necklace like the other, trying to recall it, both sick with chagrin and grief. They found in a shop at the Palais Royal a string of diamonds that seemed them exactly like the one they had lost. It was worth 40,000 francs. They could have it for 36. So they begged the jeweler not to sell it for 3 days yet, and they made a bargain that he should buy it back for 34,000 francs in case they should find the lost necklace before the end of February. Loiselle possessed 18,000 francs, which his father had left him. He would borrow the rest. He did borrow, asking 1,000 francs of one, 500 of another, 5 louis here, 3 louis there. He gave notes, took up ruinous obligations, dealt with usurers and all the race of lenders. He compromised all the rest of his life, risking signing a note without even knowing whether he could meet it. And frightened by the trouble yet to come, by the black misery that was about to fall upon him, by the prospect of all the physical privations and moral tortures that he was to suffer, he went to get the new necklace, laying upon the jeweler's counter 36,000 francs. When Madame Loisel took back the necklace, Madame Forestier said to her with a chilly manner,
"You should have returned it sooner. I might have needed it."
She did not open the case, as her friend had so much feared. If she had detected the substitution, what would she have thought? What would she have said? Would she not have taken Madame Loisel for a thief? Thereafter, Madame Loisel knew the horrible existence of the needy. She bore her part, however, with sudden heroism. That dreadful debt must be paid. She would pay it. They dismissed their servant. They changed their lodgings. They rented a garret under the roof. She came to know what heavy housework meant and the odious cares of the kitchen. She washed the dishes, using her dainty fingers and rosy nails on greasy pots and pans. She washed the soiled linen, the shirts and the dishcloths, which she dried upon a line. She carried the slops down to the street every morning and carried up the water, stopping for breath at every landing, and dressed like a woman of the people. She went to the fruitier, the grocer, the butcher, a basket on her arm, bargaining, meeting with impertinence, defending her miserable money, sou by sou. Every month they had to meet some notes, renew others, obtain more time. Her husband worked evenings, making up a tradesman's accounts, and late at night, he often copied manuscripts for 5 sous a page. This life lasted 10 years. At the end of 10 years, they had paid everything, everything, with the rates of usury and the accumulations of the compound interest. Madame Loisel looked old now. She had become the woman of impoverished households, strong and hard and rough. With frowsy hair, skirts askew and red hands, she talked loud while washing the floor with great swishes of water. But sometimes, when her husband was at the office, she sat down near the window, and she thought of that gay evening of long ago, of that ball where she had been so beautiful and so admired. What would have happened if she had not lost that necklace? Who knows? Who knows? How strange and changeful is life. How small a thing is needed to make or ruin us. But one Sunday, having gone to take a walk in the Champs-Élysées to refresh herself after the labors of the week, she suddenly perceived a woman who was leading a child. It was Madame Forestier, still young, still beautiful, still charming. Madame Loisel felt moved. Should she speak to her? Yes, certainly. And now that she had paid, she would tell her all about it. Why not? She went up. "Good day, Jeanne." The other, astonished to be familiarly addressed by this plain goodwife, did not recognize her at all and stammered,
"But, madame, I do not know. You must have mistaken."
"No, I am Mathilde Loisel."
Her friend uttered a cry.
"Oh, my poor Mathilde, how you are changed."
"Yes, I have had a pretty hard life since I last saw you, and great poverty. And that because of you."
"Of me? How so?"
"Do you remember that diamond necklace you lent me to wear at the ministerial ball?"
"Yes."
"Well?"
"Well, I lost it."
"What do you mean? You brought it back?"
"I brought you back another exactly like it, and it has taken us 10 years to pay for it. You can understand that it was not easy for us who had nothing. At last, it is ended, and I am very glad." Madame Forestier had stopped.
"You say that you bought a necklace of diamonds to replace mine?"
"Yes. You never noticed it then. They were very similar."
And she smiled with a joy that was at once proud and ingenuous. Madame Forestier, deeply moved, took her hands.
"Oh, my poor Mathilde. Why, my necklace was paste. It was worth, at most, only 500 francs.
Rheumatism Movement Cure by Robert Jones Burdett. One day, not a great while ago, Mr. Middlerib read in his favorite paper a paragraph stating that the sting of a bee was a sure cure for rheumatism, and citing several remarkable instances in which people had been perfectly cured by this abrupt remedy. Mr. Middlerib thought of the rheumatic twinges that grappled his knees once in a while and made his life a burden. He read the article several times and pondered over it. He understood that the stinging must be done scientifically and thoroughly. The bee, as he understood the article, was to be gripped by the ears and set down upon the rheumatic joint and held there until it stung itself stingless. He had some misgivings about the matter. He knew it would hurt. He hardly thought it could hurt any worse than the rheumatism, and it had been so many years since he was stung by a bee that he had almost forgotten what it felt like. He had, however, a general feeling that it would hurt some. But desperate diseases require desperate remedies, and Mr. Middlerib was willing to undergo any amount of suffering if it would cure his rheumatism. He contracted with Master Middlerib for a limited supply of bees, humming and buzzing about in the summer air. Mr. Middlerib did not know how to get them. He felt, however, that he could safely depend upon the instincts and methods of boyhood. He knew that if there was any way in heaven whereby the shyest bee that ever lifted a 200-pound man off the clover could be induced to enter a wide-mouthed glass bottle, his son knew that way. For the small sum of one dime, Master Middlerib agreed to procure several, to wit, six bees, sex and age not specified. But as Mr. Middlerib was left in uncertainty as to the race, it was made obligatory upon the contractor to have three of them honey and three humble, or in the generally accepted vernacular, bumblebees. Mr. M. did not tell his son what he wanted those bees for, and the boy went off on his mission with his head so full of astonishment that it fairly whirled. Evening brings all home, and the last rays of the declining sun fell upon Master Middlerib with a short, wide-mouthed bottle comfortably populated with hot, ill-natured bees, and Mr. Middlerib and a dime. The dime and the bottle changed hands. Mr. Middlerib put the bottle in his coat pocket and went into the house, eyeing everybody he met very suspiciously, as though he had made up his mind to sting to death the first person who said bee to him. He confided his guilty secret to none of his family. He hid his bees in his bedroom, and as he looked at them just before putting them away, he half wished the experiment was safely over. He submerged the bottle in a basin of water and let a few drops in on the heated inmates to cool them off. At the tea table, he had a great fright. Miss Middlerib, in the artless simplicity of her romantic nature, said, "I smell bees. How the odor brings up." But her father glared at her and said, with superfluous harshness and execrable grammar, "Hush up, you don't smell nothing." Whereupon Mrs. Middlerib asked him if he had eaten anything that disagreed with him, and Miss Middlerib said, "Why, Pa." And Master Middlerib smiled as he wondered. Bedtime at last, and the night was warm and sultry. Under various false pretenses, Mr. Middlerib strolled about the house until everybody else was in bed, and then he sought his room. He turned the lamp down until its feeble ray shone dimly as a death light. Mr. Middlerib disrobed slowly, very slowly. When at last he was ready to go lumbering into his peaceful couch, he heaved a profound sigh, so full of apprehension and grief that Mrs. Middlerib, who was awakened by it, said if it gave him so much pain to come to bed, perhaps he had better sit up all night. Mr. Middlerib choked another sigh, but said nothing and crept into bed. After lying still a few moments, he reached out and got his bottle of bees. It was not an easy thing to do, to pick one bee out of the bottle full with his fingers and not get into trouble. The first bee Mr. Middlerib got was a little brown honeybee that wouldn't weigh half an ounce if you picked him up by the ears, but if you lifted him by the hind leg, would weigh as much as the last end of a bay mule. Mr. Middlerib could not repress a groan. "What's the matter with you?" sleepily asked his wife. It was very hard for Mr. Milrib to say he only felt hot, but he did it. He didn't have to lie about it either. He did feel very hot indeed, about 86 all over, and 197 on the end of his thumb. He reversed the B and pressed the warlike terminus of it firmly against the rheumatic knee. It didn't hurt so badly as he thought it would. It didn't hurt at all. Then Mr. Middlerib remembered that when a honeybee stabs a human foe, it generally leaves a harpoon in the wound, and the invalid knew that the only thing this bee had to sting with was doing its work at the end of his thumb. He reached his arm out from under the sheets and dropped this disabled atom of rheumatism liniment on the carpet. Then, after a second blank wonder, he began to feel round for the bottle and wished he knew what he did with it. In the meantime, strange things had been going on. When he caught hold of the first bee, Mr. Middlerib, for reasons, drew it out in such haste that for a time he forgot all about the bottle and its remedial contents and left it lying uncorked in the bed between himself and his innocent wife. In the darkness, there had been a quiet but general emigration from that bottle. The bees, their wings clogged with the water Mr. Middlerib had poured upon them to cool and tranquilize them, were crawling aimlessly about over the sheet. While Mr. Middlerib was feeling around for it, his ears were suddenly thrilled and his heart frozen by a wild, piercing scream from his wife. "Murder!" she screamed. "Murder! Oh, help me! Help! Help!" Mr. Middlerib sat bolt upright in bed. His hair stood on end. The night was warm, but he turned to ice in a minute. "Where in thunder?" he said, with pallid lips, as he felt all over the bed in frenzied haste. "Where in thunder are them infernal bees?" And a large bumble, with a sting as pitiless as the finger of scorn, just then climbed up the inside of Mr. Middlerib's nightshirt until it got squarely between his shoulders, and then it felt for his marrow, and he said calmly, "Here is one of them." And Mrs. Middlerib felt ashamed of her feeble screams when Mr. Middlerib threw up both arms and with a howl that made the windows rattle roared, "Take him off! Oh, land of Scott! Somebody take him off!" And when a little honeybee began tickling the sole of Mrs. Middlerib's foot, she so shrieked that the house was bewitched and immediately went into spasms. The household was aroused by this time. Miss Middlerib and Master Middlerib and the servants were pouring into the room, adding to the general confusion by howling at random and asking irrelevant questions, while they gazed at the figure of a man, a little on in years, arrayed in a long nightshirt, pawing fiercely at the unattainable spot in the middle of his back, while he danced an unnatural, weird, wicked-looking jig by the dim religious light of the night lamp. And while he danced and howled, and while they gazed and shouted, a navy blue wasp that Master Middlerib had put in the bottle for good measure and variety, and to keep the menagerie stirred up, had dried his legs and wings with the corner of the sheet. And after a preliminary circle or two around the bed to get up his motion and settle down to a working gait, he fired himself across the room, and to his dying day, Mr. Middlerib will always believe that one of the servants mistook him for a burglar and shot him. Not one, not even Mr. Middlerib himself, could doubt that he was, at least for a time, most thoroughly cured of rheumatism. His own boy could not have carried himself more lightly or with greater agility. But the cure was not permanent, and Mr. Middlerib does not like to talk about it. You've been listening to From the Public Domain. I'm your host, Susie Elthens.